Hello, you're here with Tess on the Doula Tribe podcast, where we talk to expat parents about their experiences with birth, postpartum, and parenting overseas. Follow along and enjoy. I just want to acknowledge that our podcast is being held on the lands of the Yorta Yorta and Bangoran people, and I wish to acknowledge them as to traditional owners, and I would also like to pay my respects to their elders past and present and Aboriginal elders of other communities who may be here today. Now my next guest is Mick Ryan. He's been a practitioner of natural medicine for 20 years, primarily in acupuncture, sports remedial massage, reflexology, tai chi, Qigong, meditation, breathing, and TRE and movement therapy recently. He now does home care treatments for elderly people with Nimbus Health. He has two beautiful children whom he had the honour of delivering in his car on St. Patrick's Day in 2020. So welcome, Mick. I can't wait to hear all your stories.
Thank you very much.
How have you been?
Yeah, I'm doing okay. Working, looking after kids, living.
Yes, busy life.
Yeah, it is a busy life. Yeah, trying to do a bit of volunteering and helping out with the Irish community in Melbourne here too. So
I first found you on the Irish around Melbourne or Irish families around Melbourne Facebook group.
Yeah,
wasn't it? Yeah,
I think so. Yeah, or else a home from home group.
Yes, one of them, and you're very active admin on there.
I don't know what happened. Somehow I ended up kind of doing all the posts for that page. And I mean, I didn't start it. Somebody else started and somebody else was running. And somehow, you know, somewhere along the way, it seemed to be just me posting all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
People want to hear from me or not.
Well,
try and post as much relevant information for the community and sharing events that we're running.
I know. I really wish I lived in Melbourne because there's so many good things for the Irish community.
Well, it's one thing. Yeah, one thing we want to do, certainly one thing I want to do, I'm starting a podcast next week for promoting events and things for the community. And so I'd love to get involved with people like yourself in kind of regional Victoria and see if we can get things running there too and promote it as much as we can and give you that sense of community where you are. Because I'm sure there's lots of Irish people nearby that
there is
the opportunity to meet up.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's a great idea. Let's do that.
Cool.
So
it's a plan.
Thank you so much for being on my podcast. It's really rare to get a male perspective in the birth space, so I'm very excited.
Yeah, we don't always talk a lot.
No, and especially Irishmen, so congratulations to you.
Cheers.
How long have you been in Australia?
I will be here 10 years in January. So I came here January 2013. Now, I'd been here a few times beforehand. I came initially on a working holiday in 2001. I met my Australian wife in Ireland in 2005. And so we've been back and forth a few times on holiday in between before making the move at the beginning of 2013.
Amazing. What do you have any like standout differences between here and Ireland?
Competitiveness. We don't have the same competitive nature in Ireland that they do in Australia. And you know where I notice it most of all is driving. You know, whereas back home, you might wait one or two cars before somebody lets you out. Here, you could be waiting 20, 30, 40 cars before anybody stops to let you out. Somebody will eventually let you out, but it takes an awful lot longer. And that's something, that a small thing you see. People are more competitive driving, like it's a race.
Yeah.
That's an interesting thing, and it comes across in sports as well. I mean, Australia is so much more successful overall in sports, with the exception of rugby, of course. But other than that, I mean, it's a very competitive sports kind of culture, and it permeates so many facets of life here.
Yeah, it does. You're right. I have a very amazing soul reading spiritual auntie, and she told me that Australia is the power country. It's like, you know, in one of the chakras of the world where power is really important. And actually Ireland is in the heart chakra. So I don't know if you knew that. It's just really different culture here, isn't it?
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, the color of the heart chakra is green, which ties in with the Emerald Isle.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, the solar plexus chakra is the one about personal power.
Okay, so maybe it's there. That's, that must be it, right?
Yellow.
Yeah, okay, well, Australia's sports colors are yellow.
Yeah, no coincidence there, yeah.
There we go. Okay.
Funny how things like that play out, isn't it?
Isn't it? We just found out some really interesting things there. And I suppose I was just thinking when you said about your wife and your children and all this, like, do you have any specific family values that you stick to, or, you know, any key stories about your move to Australia, how that shifted for you now?
I think humility, generosity, kindness, are big things. Forgiveness is big. Empathy is big. These are things I think we really instill in our kids. And having a sense of humor too, you know, not taking yourselves too seriously are big things that we teach the kids.
Yeah. That's really good. And I hear that in your podcast and your other things that you do. You have a lot of humor that you use, and you're a bit of a singer and musician as well, aren't you?
I like to think so. Other people might not agree.
When do you do all your gigs and things like that?
I don't have any regular scheduled gigs at the moment. It's just being so busy. So, you know, I do gigs as they pop up here and there. Ideally, you know, down the line, I'll be able to create a bit more time and devote a bit more time to, because they're the things I really enjoy doing.
So your passion.
I would like to do it more often. Yeah, very much so. Yeah.
Very good. Can you describe your work? What are you passionate about right now?
So at the moment, I work for a company called Nimbus Health, and I provide home care treatments for seniors and the elderly who have home care packages, which are funded by the Australian government, which is a great thing that the Australian government do for seniors, is that anyone over the age of 65 is eligible to apply for a home care package or a range of services, you know, from somebody who's a carer or somebody who might help out with showers or with prepping food or doing gardening to physiotherapy or osteopathy and occupational therapy. Somebody like myself who comes in and does acupuncture, massage or podiatry, all these services are available for people in their home, paid for by the government.
Wow.
And it's pretty amazing, yeah, that they do this, and they have different levels. So people can have quite significant funding, you know, maybe up to $80,000 or so a year if there's a need there for it.
Yeah, and we wouldn't see that in Ireland, would we?
Not to that extent, really. No, definitely not. So it's an amazing thing that they do here.
Yeah, that is really amazing.
And I think the idea is it's a home care package. It's designed to, I guess, keep people out of nursing homes and keep people at home for as long as possible. I think people's prognosis and outcomes are better the longer they stay at home.
Yeah, and so people are living longer too, aren't they?
People are existing longer.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily always know if people are living longer, because we're sick for a much longer period. And we really so that's one thing that I'm learning through doing this job, because I spent so many years as a holistic practitioner and working with people, and now I'm working primarily with the elderly, and I'm seeing so much of it is about movement and the lack of movement. And once people feel pain or discomfort and they stop moving because of that, they deteriorate quite quickly. And if they could work through that and keep the movement going, they would actually feel so much better. And, you know, movement is such an important part of our well-being overall.
Yeah, of course. And you can see that even, I'm going to tie it back to birth, but when a woman is in labor, if she doesn't keep moving and she just sits on her back or on the bed, you know, then she's in pain. She's screaming. Whereas if we keep moving, we can move through that pain, move that through that contraction.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So that ties
nicely. We certainly
saw that. Yeah, it ties nicely into my next question about your own birth of your children. Do you want to tell me a little bit about those?
So my son was born in 2016 in October. We went to the maternity group practice at the Mercy Hospital here in Melbourne. And the great thing about the maternity group practice is it's run by midwives. So we didn't actually have a pediatrician an obstetrician or gynecologist throughout the process. We just had we had the midwives who we worked with. And even in the birthing process, it was our midwife actually wasn't available that day because she was off. So it was always a midwife on. So we had a different midwife that day who my wife was familiar with. And she just spent the whole, you know, day with us, just helping us through the birthing process, just the three of us really as a team until the very, 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 very end. When things got a little hairy for a few minutes and there was a whole team of, you know, the obstetrician came in and a couple of nurses and a couple of other doctors and stuff like that. And actually there was a pediatrician came in then too. So they had a whole team. But
How did you find all those people rushing into your birth space?
That is pretty intimidating at the time because you wonder, oh my God, what's going on? Is this serious? You know, it was just the three of us, everything was going fine, and suddenly, you know, all hell's breaking loose.
Yeah, of course.
So you panic a little at the time because you don't know, you're not familiar with it, but everything was okay in the end.
Yeah, good. And so he come down the birth canal naturally and come out with...
mostly naturally. There was a little bit of gas going on there, and I think my wife also had the morphine drip at one stage. I remember she turned around saying, "This isn't working." I said, "Well, you know, you haven't been screaming for a while, so I must be doing something."
That's hilarious. And so he was born, and it was all good. Everything was perfect.
It doesn't be perfect. No. But I mean, it could have been a lot worse. What we found, he didn't latch very well for the first couple of weeks, and that's quite traumatic.
It is
for the parents. I mean, for a mother, of course, as well, wanting to connect with your baby who just doesn't seem to be latching at all. And from our perspective, you know, trying to pump and use a colostrum to feed him, and as I'm sure you know, colostrum is not very much at all. It's really tiny amounts of this substance, which is really important for immunity and stuff as well, but we were pumping and getting these tiny amounts and just, you know, using a little tiny syringe to inject it into his mouth, and he really lost quite a bit of weight after coming out of the hospital. And what I didn't know at the time was that when you have the morphine drip, that it artificially inflates the birth weight.
A lot of people don't know that, Mick.
Yeah. And we didn't know that. I only found out afterwards. And
well, they're not going to tell you, are they?
No. So we after, when the midwife came around and weighed him and stuff like that and reported back to an obstetrician or a pediatrician, probably a pediatrician. The message coming back to us was, you know, if he doesn't put on weight in the next 48 hours, we're taking him back into hospital, which is quite confronting for a parent because you feel like you're failing your baby. You know, he's losing weight, he's supposed to be putting on weight, and you only find out afterwards that his weight was artificially inflated anyway. You think that breastfeeding is something that comes really natural, that the baby just latches and that's it, but it's not always the way.
No, it can be quite sore, and you know, you can get really engorged.
Yeah,
and there's lots happening.
Even without teeth, there can be still quite a bit of biting that goes on. And it can be quite painful. Yeah,
they have to learn the skill as well, you know.
They do. Yeah,
and it's the other thing people saying,
you know, sleep like a baby. Well, you know, anyone who says that probably hasn't had a baby, because babies can be terrible at sleeping.
Both of ours were to begin with.
Yeah, yeah, and really needed a lot of coaching and a lot of work with them to get them to learn how to sleep.
Yes, it can be really, really tiresome, and you know, sleep deprivation is dangerous.
It is exhausting. It really is. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. And how is your postpartum? So the 6 weeks after, or, you know, it can go on for months after your son was born.
It was tiring because his sleep was really disturbed. He wasn't napping during the day. You know, maybe some cat naps here and there, but not very good at all at it. And then wasn't really sleeping great at night either.
Right. And
you up all hours of the night just jumping up and down with him.
Yeah.
trying to rock him to sleep.
Yeah.
And it took about 6 months for us. We ended up going to sleep school when he was 6 months old. But By the time we got to sleep school, I was like, we don't need to be here anymore because he's starting to suss this out. And he had pretty much a 6 months he started to get his sleep right. And then, you know, ever since then has been a champion sleeper. And the same story pretty much with my daughter. Up until 6 months, she was a terrible, terrible sleeper. Mm. And then from there on in, then she was just amazing sleeper.
Really?
Just, you know, goes down at night at 7 o'clock and that's it until the following morning.
Yeah. Amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, but it took a lot of work.
Yeah, and I have heard recently, like, that if they've had any bit of trauma, like, and their perception of trauma can be really small, like, you know, a bright light or a sound or a smell in the labor room or afterwards in the hospital, it can be anything. They're always seeking to repair, like the body is, and so, you know, this crying and the awakeness can be, and this kind of, you know, seeking out comfort can be just them trying to repair or move through some kind of trauma, things like that. Like, babies can be quite unsettled in the first few months because of that. So that's
it makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because what we didn't know at the time, of course, we only found out significantly later, is my son was diagnosed with ASD at the age of 3, 3 and a half. And so, you know, that sensory sensitivity that you have at ASD would have made a lot of sense for a small baby coming out, like, you know, heightened sensitivity to sound and to light and to sensation and all these things that would disturb him after being so cozy in the womb.
Of course.
Would take a long time to process. And, you know, he's still, you know, at the age of 6, working on processing that and, you know, finding a way to be in the world.
Yeah, of course. Yes. And that's the thing, isn't it? We just don't know because they can't talk to us, but it's a case of just trying to be there for them and just be holding them and tell them we're listening.
Yeah.
That's what we can do as parents, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Just offer as much comfort as you can. Yeah.
And it does pass.
It does. Yeah, it does gradually get better. I mean, I feel like the first, you know, probably 8 weeks is really, you know, you're in the trenches and then you're gradually clawing your way out as you go.
Yes, absolutely.
But, you know, 2 months is not that long in the greater scheme of things. It seems like forever at the time. But and, it does pass quite quickly and it does gradually get better.
I'm interested to know, would you have found a doula, you know, helpful at that time? In the first few weeks where they're coming in and bringing you nice food and helping with some stuff around the house and keeping mom happy and looking after mom?
Yeah, I think it would have made a big difference. Yeah, I've known the people who do that. Having said that, now we did have Chandra's sister and a friend of ours who was around at the time who were really, really helpful and grateful to have them there.
Yeah.
And I guess fulfilling in some ways a similar role to a doula.
Yeah.
But just not being able to devote the time because that wasn't their job.
Yes.
You know, so they have to fit it around working and living and having their own. In terms of my sister-in-law had her having her own kids, so we can only devote so much time. But to have someone like that would make such a huge difference. And that's what you don't have when you're at home. You can have your family or your, you know, your mother or mother-in-law, wherever, to help in that way. Whereas here, you know, you don't necessarily have that sense of community around you. You have to really work harder at developing that here.
Yeah, we do. Yeah. And so with your daughter, she was born in your care. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so my wife was in with the midwife. It was on St. Patrick's Day, 2020. My wife was in the midwife that morning.
In the thick of COVID as well, Mick.
We were 2 days away from going into our first lockdown.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and it was all new and we knew nothing about it. And it was all, you know, that was the only story that was going on. There was a lot of fear and a lot of trepidation and nobody knowing. You couldn't go to the hospital and, you know, I couldn't even bring my son in to see his sister when she was born.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, but it was a lot going on at the time. And I was in work and my wife, the midwife had told her that my daughter was due on the 19th.
Yeah.
And I said, no, she's not. She's coming on St. Patrick's Day. And it wasn't just because I was Irish. I'd also had an app set up, and the app was telling me that was St. Patrick's Day. So I was going by that too. And so, you know, that suits me. But whatever timeline the midwife was working on was different. And well, my daughter, Lakshmi, obviously wanted to do her daddy proud. And so she insisted on coming St. Patrick's Day, whether the midwife was ready or not. And I was working, and my wife had gone in to see the midwife that morning. And what the midwife didn't tell her at the time, but we found out later, was that she went from being 2 inches dilated to being, or sorry, 2 centimeters dilated to 5 centimeters, got 2 inches dilated, 2 to 5 centimeters.
In how long?
She was there, and just the time that she was with her.
Like an so hour, she went, max.
Yeah, probably. Wow. Yeah, I'm not sure exactly. But she went off anyway to a cafe on her way home and had her breakfast and, you know, a nice pot of chai, and then drove home. And at 11:30 then that morning, she called me up and she said, I'm having these cramps. I'm like, well, what are they like? She said, well, you know, they're happening every couple of minutes and they're really intense. And I asked for about 30 seconds. And I'm like, that's not cramps you're having. That's contractions. And that's quite frequent. So I left work immediately and raced home with her on speakerphone, gradually listening to her, you know, contractions increasing, and go home to her lying on the bed. In hindsight, probably should have stayed there, but, you know, we thought we'll try and get to the hospital. We thought we had more time than we did. And, you know, we were less than 10 minutes from the house. I had a midwife on the phone talking us through, and she just said, yeah, listen to my wife in the car beside me. She said, you're not going to make it here. Just pull over and call an ambulance. And so that's what we did, and found the nearest spot that we could pull over. Called 000, had them on the line. They had an ambulance on the way, but, you know, I think it took 12 minutes for the ambulance to come. And I just jumped out of the driver's seat, went around to my wife, and she's sitting in the passenger seat, and she was still wearing her knickers at this stage. And I had to pull her knickers aside. Couldn't even take them off. Just had to pull them aside. And the moment I pulled them aside, the baby's head, my daughter's head, just popped out. It was like, oh my, the only thing keeping her in were the bloody knickers.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and so Chandra's was screaming, but it was really short-lived. It was really only a few minutes of intense, you know, full-on labor. Because, you know, Lakshmi, she was coming out on her terms, and she's been like that ever since, you know. She doesn't compromise, and everything's on her terms.
Yeah.
And so she was coming out. She was coming out like a torpedo.
Wow.
And, I just managed to you know, get knickers aside, get ready. The floor of my car was filthy. Didn't have time to do anything about that. And, you know, had to try and, you know, catch her. After a couple of pushes, she was right out. Once the head popped out, that's it. Everything else is fairly easy.
Yes. And
yeah. I managed to catch her. Of course, you know, newborn babies are pretty slippy.
Mm.
So that wasn't easy. But one thing that is really scary, and I'd say this for, if that ever happens to anybody, when her head came out, she was just purple. And her eyes were closed and she wasn't breathing. And I'm like, oh my God, something's wrong here. What do we do? What do I have no help?
They're breathing through the umbilical cord.
Of course, everything's coming through there. And you don't know that until she actually comes out fully.
Yeah.
And it takes a couple of seconds, you know, that feel like a year. And then she just, you know, takes a big breath and lets out a scream like, oh, thank God, she's okay. And handed her to Chandra sitting in the passenger seat. And then realized this is 35 degrees and we're in direct sunlight beating down on the two of them at midday.
Well, it was my God.
145 or 147 to be precise.
That's she came hot. Out.
So I had to kind of shield them. Yeah, shield them from this sun, because she's just, you know, come out of the womb, like 30 seconds of sunlight is going to burn her.
Yeah, did you wrap her in anything or?
Chandra just held her like that, and we put, I don't know, I can't even remember if we had a blanket or anything like that even to put over. Like, we really weren't prepared at all.
Obviously.
At this stage, yeah. Like, everything caught us by surprise, and the ambulance came after 12 minutes, which...
Oh, it would have been a long time to wait.
But it was, but it just showed how quickly she came out after pulling over.
Yeah.
I mean, she was instant. You know, there was no waiting around. You know, we were waiting there for quite a while after she came out before the ambulance even arrived. So she was she was in a hurry.
And babies come when baby are ready. And isn't that
the
quote of the
do.
Day?
Yeah.
And how was the placenta? Like, was that like delivered while you were waiting?
They delivered that in the ambulance while I sat in the car and they were off in the ambulance and delivering the placenta. So I was waiting. So what's going on here? It took a while, but yeah, eventually they did. And they drove off to the hospital. And well, look, I couldn't follow an ambulance. because they're able to race through lights and everything, and you know, I'm just following along behind.
Yeah, okay.
But eventually caught up with them at the hospital and everything was fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fab. What a great story. Like,
It is, yeah,
I
except
feel
we got
like you
lost, of
could
course, amidst all
really.
the COVID.
Oh, I know, but like you should write it down or capture it for your daughter because it's so special. Brilliant.
It is, yeah.
And so how was postpartum after your daughter? Did you learn anything from having your son abroad? Like, did you put any new practices into play?
Yeah, it was definitely different. We had more friends around, I think, in some ways, but at the same time we were into COVID, so we couldn't really see anybody. Once we went into the lockdown, it was very difficult. So it was good in the sense that I was able to spend more time at home. But yeah, you just couldn't go anywhere. So it was a challenging time in that sense, you know, having a baby in COVID.
Yeah, it would be.
Yeah. So
And
while we did have more friends, we couldn't see anybody.
I know, like, I mean, we're all still reeling from the COVID lockdowns.
Yeah.
But do you know anything about postpartum depression for men? Is that something that you have encountered?
I don't know a huge amount about it, but look, I know it's an emotional roller coaster. Like, I remember just going back to talking about my son and that time when they were saying, oh, we're going to take him back in the hospital. And I remember trying to feed him and just breaking down, crying, just so much emotion coming out, and just this sense of failing my baby. You know, it's that, I can see how that can go on. And it's also, you know, the exhaustion of the whole thing as well, and the sleep deprivation can be such a massive thing in your overall well-being.
Yeah, of course.
You know, and if you are, you want to help out as much, you know, I want to be very active always with my kids. So, you know, you're helping out at night time and doing a lot to give your wife a break or your partner a break. And yeah, it can be, I can see how it can have that effect.
Yeah, and can you, I suppose, have you experienced that? Like, a lot of people would come around and they'd ask the mother how she is and how's the baby, but they don't really ask the dads. No one really
Yeah.
says, oh, how are you?
Yeah, I get, and I understand that, you know, the focus is on, you know, everybody else. Like the burden of the work does fall on the mom anyway. You know, there's just no way around that. You're there to just to offer support at the beginning as much as you can. And but I really, I tried to be as active as I could in the whole process.
That's good. Do you know, like, any services that men can, check out if they're feeling like that way, or if there's anyone listening here today?
So people might have heard of men's sheds that you know, it's more skill based, where you might do some woodwork or some making things and stuff like that. And you know, it's just what other men, it can be quite a supportive environment, but there's also men's groups where you can just go and talk and just be open about what's going on. And there's Men's Wellbeing Australia, which is a website and administers lots of groups all around Australia. There's also Men's Weekends, which are amazing. I went to one called Menergy, and it was just a great weekend. I'd highly recommend it for anybody who's open in that way, where you talk about a lot of things. You know, there's workshops running all day long and different things. It might be meditation, it might be different aspects of spirituality, psychology, movement, Tai Chi, Qigong, yoga, things like that, making things. Really great weekends for men, to support men
Yeah,
in
that's
ways that we don't
great.
often do. So yeah, I'd highly recommend looking into men's well-being,
That's a
particularly
website,
because
is
all
it?
of yeah.
So, Mick, I was just wondering about tying back to when you said your son had ASD, how you found, I suppose, all the services in Australia, like the, I suppose, access to the services that kids with ASD need and that extra support. Like, do you find that different here to Ireland?
From what I understand, yes. I mean, obviously, not having had my son in Ireland, or knowing much about what it was like in Ireland before, I've learned a little bit about it since. From what I can tell, it's not great. I remember seeing one report about a mother talking about her son and, looking for early intervention. And this is somebody who lived in Blanchardstown in Dublin, so not too far from where I used to live.
Yeah.
And she was saying that she was told it would take, I think, 3 to 4 was the number she was given to get assessed. And she said, all right, 3 to 4 months. She said, no, 3 to 4 years.
What?
I was like, how can that be? So, like, you know, is early intervention over by that stage?
Yeah.
And she said, like, that's how long it was taking just to get assessed for having ASD.
Is that public?
It must be. Yeah. Mm. And to be honest, look, it can be the issue here too. That it can take a long time to get assessed unless you're willing to pay for someone to do it. And we paid, you know, we just stumped up the money because we knew it was essential.
Yeah.
And it was essential for us in order to get NDIS funding. And NDIS is what they have here. It's the National Disability Insurance Scheme. And once you get your assessment by a psychologist or a psychiatrist, but I think it's probably cheaper to get it done by a psychologist, and that's good enough.
Yeah.
Then you can apply for NDIS funding. And my son was 4 at the time, and we applied for NDIS funding, and we got a package. I think it worked out about $28,000 to pay for his supports over the course of the year for speech therapy and occupational therapy and psychology and social skills groups and all these things. And
yeah,
even
they need
in-home
so
support.
Much, don't they? Like, there's so many appointments.
There is, yeah. And then my wife, after a few months, she applied for reassessment, and we actually got bumped up to $38,000.
Amazing.
For these early intervention supports. And so, look, that's a lot of money that you can put towards supports. Now, trust me, you can spend it. You can spend it quite quickly.
Oh, God, yeah.
But it's a lot of supports to pay for those specialists. And, you know, they really make a difference. Having the occupational therapist. And the occupational therapist, I think most of all, has been the biggest help at this stage.
For
I think as kids get older, I think that changes. Maybe psychologist comes more to the fore, but when they're younger, those kind of supports and helping with social skills. And we do Lego social skills, and, you know, he does a basketball social skills group. And
great.
Yeah, it's there really is a huge amount of support and a huge amount of awareness here that I don't think we get back home. And, you know, looking at that, I think I'm really grateful that, you know, we had him here rather than back home, because he needs so much support. And we're lucky also in the school that we go to. We chose a school that was nearby that had small classes in prep of, you know, 15 kids. And also because the principal had a son who had ASD. So we figure, well, you know, if anyone's going to understand, you know, it's him.
Yeah.
And, you know, we end up being really lucky that, you know, he's an amazing teacher and gets great support in school as well, and a lot of understanding.
And it's
Certainly a lot more than I ever got.
Standard nowadays anyway, but isn't it amazing when you have the school and everyone kind of more on board, and the government even are supportive of families now?
They are, yeah.
Whereas
yeah,
at home, I feel
so.
Like they are still sweeping it under the rug a little bit, like classic, you know.
Yeah, I mean,
and
I really don't know.
I used to work in disability, you know, and it's hard work because you end up in residential care if you don't have an early intervention, and young people get really severe autism, they just can't live at home. It's really sad.
It can happen like that, all right, yeah.
You know, and we've had, like, I used to work with a boy who had 3 staff on him all day. I mean, and he was 14.
Wow.
You know, the government just doesn't value the early intervention stuff, you know.
But how much does it cost for those 3 staff then?
I know.
And if that money was spent at a young age,
talk about
how
crisis.
Much would it save?
It's like, it's silly.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, that's another story, isn't it? But here I feel like that is definitely something you have to consider, is when you're abroad, are the services better for your children, you know?
Yeah, it's one thing. It's a trade-off. Look, with Australia, this country, as you know, is expensive. It's an expensive place to live. But because everything's so expensive, everyone gets paid well. And that's one of the reasons it's so expensive, because everyone gets paid well.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there's certain standards of pretty much everything across the board, which are really high. And there's a lot of accountability for those things as well.
Yeah, definitely. And that's it, isn't it? It's like, is there a trade-off for not having family, but is it a good place to raise children? And it's all got its pros and cons, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it is good here too.
Yeah.
My gut feeling is that I like it here, and I wouldn't be here otherwise, I don't think.
Of course. Yeah. And one thing that I've really been passionate about and getting involved in is the Irish community and is the supports that are available. Whether you're talking about the Irish Australian Support and Resource Bureau, which I'm a member of, and I'm currently on the committee.
What do they do,
Celtic Club and Gaelic Port. Well, the Bureau was really about supporting the community. But supporting all levels of the community, whether you're talking about seniors or whether you're talking about young families. And, you know, if people are in difficulty and need help, you can reach out to the Bureau. If you need help with a passport, you can reach out to the Bureau. You know, there's even a benevolent fund that when people are struggling, you know, you can go to the Bureau and say, look, I'm struggling to pay my rent this month. You know, we're on hard times, you know, and there are people in the community that will put their hand in the pocket and help out.
Great.
And there's a benevolent fund for those kind of things that happen. And so the Bureau really is, it's the Support and Resource Bureau. It's there for the Irish community.
Great. That's amazing. Yeah.
It is. Yeah. To know that it's there. I mean, I didn't know it was when I came here. I didn't know it was there. And I just heard it through a friend and I went along and, you know, it's been great. And that's where you can get that sense of community and that connection with people. And there's other people in the same boat as yourself who want to meet up, you know.
Yeah.
So you develop that sense of community if you're willing to just put a little bit of time into it.
Definitely. I agree. And that's it. It's some people don't really know as well. So
no, and that's the thing. And that's what I really want to do again to the podcast that I'm publishing is, you know, letting people know that you're not alone. There are supports. There are people around just like you. And there is a whole community here of people that want to be together.
Yeah. Yeah. And support each other.
Yeah.
And there's no place like home. There's no place like Irish people. There's no humor.
We get each other. Yeah. We have, I mean, it's not just a sense of humor. It's just you have, we get each other in a way that we have a sense of humor like Australians in the sense that they like a laugh as well in many ways, but not in the same way that Irish people do. And I remember my cousin had traveled around the world and she came back and said, oh, you know, the Australians, they don't have the same sense of humor as we do. So they don't. They have a sense of humor. It's just different.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean it's worse or better. It's just when you're around people who have a similar sense of humor, you're just more at ease or similar values or, you know, similar understanding of things. You're just more at ease within yourself, knowing that you're understood.
Yeah, it's a sense of identity, I reckon.
Yeah.
We have a very strong patriotism, I reckon, in Ireland.
Yeah, we do.
And so, you know, that sense of identity comes through really strongly in us, doesn't it?
It does, but it's funny. I spoke about this to somebody as well recently, and I said, the one thing, though, that it's a great advantage, but it's also a disadvantage, is that we speak English and we come to Australia and we're treated like we're cousins.
Yeah.
You know, we're accepted in a way that many other cultures aren't.
Yeah.
But the flip side of that is we can get lost in it a little bit, whereas other cultures have this really strong sense of connection and community by having to band together because they don't maybe have that language thing that able to integrate in the same way that we do. So they have this really strong sense of community connection. And you see it in the Italian community and the Greek community and more recently probably in the likes of the Indian community or the Chinese community. They really have to band together because, you know, they might have difficulty communicating with people. Whereas we don't have that when we come to Australia and we're accepted in a way that they probably wish they were. But at the same time, it can kind of, we're almost like that our sense of identity within Australia isn't quite as strongly recognized as those other communities.
Yeah.
Because we're not seen as being separate so much as those communities are.
Yeah,
it's a trade-off.
You just get the odd comment like, I love your accent. I could listen to you all day.
Yeah.
That's all I get.
People will
try
and do your accent. It's like, can you imagine saying that to an Indian person? How that would be taken?
I know. You can't do that.
Yeah.
But we laugh it off. But, you know,
we do. People do it all the time. But it's like, you know, It's actually not okay to do that.
It's very offensive.
Yeah.
I know what you mean. That's it. And so tell me about your podcast and how people can connect with you, Mick, because this has been a brilliant chat and you're a really great advocate for, you know, the Irish community and for males out there who need to connect with others and things like that. So I really want people to know how to connect with you as well.
So, yeah, the plan is to go live next week with the podcast. It's called Mix Down Under. And starting off initially, primarily around Melbourne and Victoria, promoting pubs and you know, organizations like the Bureau or like Celtis or like the Celtic Club or Gaelic Park. And really trying to promote that sense of connection and community, sharing events that are relevant to the Irish community and letting people know about that. And ideally having somebody on every week that might be next week. I think we have Caroline McDade, who owns McDade's pub down in Rosebud. She's going to come on there launching their own beer next month. And she's going to come on and talk about that and all the events that they have on and tell her story about, I guess, similar to what we're doing about how she came to Australia and how she came to own a pub and all those things. And that's the kind of stories you want to tell.
Yes.
And the information we want to give out there. So, you know, we'll have more information on the Facebook page and Google as well. So I think it's Mixed Down Under is the Facebook page, and the podcast will be on Anchor. I'll be recording it on, but it'll be broadcasting, I think, on whatever Spotify and iTunes and everywhere else that it goes out.
Yeah, brilliant.
Yeah, and it's a resource for people. Now, ideally, I'm actually going to try the first few episodes broadcasting live and see how we go. So if people want to interact and take part in it and, you know, send messages or call in and be a part of the show, I'd be happy to have that go on. And, you know, my idea is that, yeah, you might have a joke here and there. We want to have a bit of banter and a bit of a laugh with people as well and entertain while providing information. You know, might end up finishing with a song each week or maybe get a guest on to do a song each week as well. And, you know, have a little bit of entertainment as well as information.
Oh, very exciting. I can't wait for that.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. It's exciting. So got a few great guests already lined up. Next week is the plan. Yeah.
Wow.
So the fourth episode is going to be with Caroline. And I'm hoping that as we build all the other pubs and venues and anything else that's going on are going to get in touch with us and let us know what their event guide is, so we can share it out and let people know in advance that it's happening, and to really just build that sense of community and connection.
Yeah, perfect. That's all we want, isn't it? As human beings.
Community and connection, very much so. We're social creatures,
It's, well, I really appreciate having you on today, Mick. It's been a brilliant, eye-opening story, and I wish you all the best with your new podcast and your new ventures, and we'll talk soon.
Thank you so much, Tess. I really appreciate it.
No worries, Mick. See ya.
Great to talk to you. Take care.
Well, that's a wrap, and I just want to thank everyone for listening today. Mick was very insightful around living abroad with children and, you know, the men's access to different organizations and supports groups and weekends away that they can do, retreats. I think that was probably my takeaway. That's really important for men to know those things. And if you're listening as a woman, tell your man. You know, these things can get a little bit sidetracked, and I think men's health is just as important as women's, and especially in the doula world, you know, today we can often get wrapped up in the women and the babies, but men are important too, and we need to ask the dads how they're feeling or the partners after the birth, because they can have trauma and they can perceive things differently. So that's been my experience as well. So if anything has triggered you today or you want to chat more, just get in contact. And there's also lots of online support groups. Panda is one. And you can check out the other things that Mick shared as well. And thank you again for listening.